happily. Mrs. Chatworth throws down her napkin and pushes away from the table.
Enough of this! I will not stand for it in my own house, this talk of witchery and heathen queens.
Mother, Billy chides, you sound so old-fashioned.
Proper is what I sound, and if Miss Arsinoe is having some sort of episodes, the kindest thing to do for her would be to refer her to a physician, not to let her roam around the city by herself getting into more trouble.
She stands and smooths her dress.
Jane, let us retire into the drawing room.
Jane does as she is bid, but casts a rather longing look over her shoulder. After they have gone and the doors between them are shut, Mirabella puts her head in her hands.
Until last night, I would have agreed with her about the physician.
That is something like a healer, yes?
Yes, but when she says physician, all she means is a quack who will determine that Arsinoe is suffering from hysteria. They'd lock her away in a sanatorium.
Mirabella grimaces, and Billy glances at her.
It was chaos in that room last night, he says. So I didn't mention it, but I saw what your gift did up there. I saw that candle light without a match.
How did you do it?
I did it for her, Mirabella replies. Arsinoe needed me to do it, so I did. Sometimes I think that is my true purpose. Not to be queen, like the Westwoods and Luca convinced me of, but to protect her. Just to protect her.
The Road from Bastion City. Jules, Camden, Emilia, and Mathilde creep out of Bastion City beneath the cover of dark. They have only the supplies that can be carried on their backs and what money can be stuffed into their pockets. As they pass through the outer wall and move on to the main road, Emilia suddenly stops.
What is it?
Jules asks, and Emilia bursts into muffled laughter.
It occurs to me, she says when she is quieted, that in our haste for revolution, we have neglected to decide where to start.
Jules groans. So does Camden, leaning heavily against her good leg.
Well, there are not too many choices. Do we head north for Rolanth, or west toward Wolf Spring?
Neither, says Emilia.
Word from Rolanth suggests they are still too bitter about their loss, yet also still too loyal to the temple.
And why not Wolf Spring?
Have your bards made it there yet? What are they saying about the uprising?
They may have heard rumors, Mathilde says, but it is still too soon.
In my experience, it is best to allow naturalists to warm to ideas slowly.
What's that supposed to mean? Jules asks.
It means they are fast to say no. Nothing more.
It means they still hate the Legion curse, Emilia adds, less kindly. Better to avoid Wolf Spring a while. Dealings with naturalists are uncertain under the best of circumstances. They never want to get involved in anything.
Hey, Jules says, I'm a naturalist.
Yes, and you are the only one here who does not really want to rise.
Fine.
So where then are we supposed to start?
Mathilde adjusts her pack on her shoulders and begins to walk.
Why not start where we have already begun?
My home of Sunpool is with us, as are many of the surrounding villages.
They have been preparing for months, for they believe in the prophecy.
She gestures up the road.
We will go south around the capital, and then skirt the mountains to the east. Once we are far enough north, we will begin speaking to the towns, until the new force meets the existing one.
She looks at them over her shoulder, smile and white braid flashing in the moonlight.
Then, we will circle back for Wolf Spring and Rolanth.
At least there is an inn, Emilia says, when they arrive in the village. So we will not have to sleep in a barn.
A barn might be wiser, says Jules,
Easier to run out the back if they don't like your rabble-rousing and come for us with pitchforks. She arches an eyebrow at the warrior, but Amelia is too tired to argue much. It has been a long walk on the roads and off the roads, cutting through fields and forests to avoid Indrid Down. All of them are weary, their cloaks and faces stained with dirt, in need of fresh supplies and a good wash. Even tall, elegant Mathilde looks like she wrestled a pig and lost. Come on. Mathilde adjusts her pack and leads them to the inn. Jules glances back up the road toward the place she left Camden dozing in a patch of ferns. The cat will wait there until she is called. The interior of the inn is not much. Just one large room on the ground floor full of tables and wooden benches. A few men and women sit alone or in pairs, hunched over bowls of stew. Do you have rooms for rent? Mathilde asks.
Wouldn't be much of an inn if we didn't, replies the girl behind the counter. How many will you be needing?
Just one, large enough to sleep three. Mathilde drops a few coins on the counter, and the girl slides them into her palm. Does that also buy dinner?
Nearly. But you look so worn down that I'll say it does. Another silver will buy you a hot tub of water to wash in.
Amelia slaps two coins down.
We'll take two tubs, and we'll eat our meal here in your fine room.
As you like. The girl studies them a moment, but if she finds them odd, two filthy warriors and an oracle bard in a stained gray and yellow cloak, she does not comment on it. Perhaps, as a keeper of an inn, she is used to strange travelers. Though Jules cannot imagine that many choose to stop in this tiny village.
Are you fleeing from the capital?
The girl asks, and both Jules and Amelia tense.
We've had some folk from there passing through, after what happened.
What happened? Asks Mathilde. We have been traveling for some time. We have not heard.
Queen Catherine murdered a boy.
Murdered? Jules gasps. But the girl only cocks her head and sighs, as if it is no longer news at all for how many times she has had to tell it.
Aye, right in front of everyone. More bodies had washed up on the shores of the capital, and the people were panicked. They started shouting at her and throwing things. One little boy broke loose and ran at her with something, probably no more than a stick. But she sliced his head off, easy as you please.
Where was her queen's guard? Amelia asks.
Dealing with the grown-sized people, I'd imagine.
The girl's lips curl in disgust. Then she cocks her head again and slips their coins into her pocket.
Two tubs will take a while, but I'll get my boys on it. You can head up to your room now if you like. I'll have them brought in.
She points up the stairs behind her.
First one up those stairs, or any of them. They're all empty.
As soon as they get inside their room, someone knocks at the door, the boys delivering the empty tubs.
Water will take some time, says the first boy. Most folks don't want to.
Thank you, says Amelia, and closes the door behind him.
I didn't want to either,
she says, turning toward Jules.
But there's a bug's arse of a chance of me sharing a tub with a mountain cat.
Why not just have Camden go last? Mathilde asks. The tub would be cold by then. Jules takes off her pack and stretches her shoulders. The hot bath will be welcome. The travel has been hard on her poison-damaged legs. Some nights, they have throbbed so bad she has felt like screaming. But still she pushed on, not wanting to admit she should stop. She always said that Arsinoe had a stubborn streak a river wide, but really, her own might have been even wider.
Do you believe what she said? Jules asks as she sits down on the soft bed. Do you think Catherine really murdered some little boy?
Maybe she did, and maybe she didn't, replies Amelia. It will make it easier to bring this village to our cause in any case.
Mathilde unbraids her golden hair
and runs her fingers through it to rid it of twigs and leaf bits. A queen who kills her own people. One would think she was trying to lose her head.
Eh, Amelia says, a dismissive sound. For once, I will not be too hard on her.
There was a mob. The boy charged at her with a raised weapon. He had it coming.
Had it coming? Jules asks, and Amelia tips the knife she has been playing with lazily toward her chest.
You don't threaten the life of a queen and live to tell the tale.
She flips the knife, catches it.
Taking the life of a queen?
Now that is another matter.
By the time they descend the stairs and head into the main room for supper, most of the tables are full. It seems to please Amelia and Mathilde. They can hold their meeting right in the inn. No need to try and gather people scattered through the village. But Jules would like to walk straight back up the stairs. They sit down at a table near the wall, their arrival attracting a few curious glances. The girl from before sets down 3 cups of ale.
Stew tonight, and some oat bread. If you want more ale than what's in these cups, it'll cost you more coin.
What's in the stew? Jules asks.
Meat,
the girl replies, and then goes to fetch it. Jules looks around the inn. Nearly everyone in town must have come to the inn for supper, and it makes her wonder whether Amelia and Mathilde had somehow sent word of their coming. But if they had, no one seems particularly interested in them past the first glance. So maybe the meat stew is just very good.
Do you really think we should start here? Jules asks. We're still not that far from the capital.
We're far enough. Amelia swallows half her cup of ale.
Sounds like they've got their hands full with a murderous queen.
We probably could have walked closer to the border and saved ourselves some time.
But look at these people. They're farmers, tanners, many too old to fight.
This is what rebel soldiers look like. Amelia's dark eyes sparkle.
What? You have something better to do? Exile? Fugitive?
She grins and pushes Jules's mug toward her.
Drink more and think less, Legion Queen.
Don't call me that.
Why not?
Amelia wrinkles her nose at Mathilde. That is the one that people seem to have liked the most, isn't it?
Jules snorts. Who would like such a title? It is as bad as being called undead, or perhaps even worse. You will never convince them that way.
They have lived under the poisoners, too. They won't need much convincing.
Amelia drains her mug and calls loudly for more ale. Her exuberant hand gestures and overall loudness have begun to attract more attention. And, as the villagers look toward Amelia, their gazes linger on Jules with something above mere curiosity, as if they sense something that makes her worth staring at.
Ridiculous, Jules mutters,
too quietly for even her table mates to hear. But she would be lying if she said she was not curious, too. Every time a stranger looks at her with something like hope sparks inside her and nearly tricks her into breathing again. Nearly, but not quite.
Hope is for fools, she wants to tell them. Not long ago I hoped for everything, and look what has become of me and those I loved. This is never going to work, Jules says.
Of course it will, says Amelia. You have not seen how Mathilde can mesmerize with her voice. She'll hold these people in the palm of her hand.
It is why I became a bard, Mathilde says, and smiles.
Amelia prods Jules in the shoulder.
You do not want it to work.
Of course I do. I want to be able to go home. I want Arsinoe to be able to come back and visit us.
Amelia's voice sinks low.
Do not speak of that.
Why not?
If she returns, she will want the crown.
No, she wouldn't.
Yes, she would,
It is in her triplet blood, and we are not rising to put the traitor queens back on the throne. We are rising for ourselves, for Fenburn.
Would you have done the same if Catarine had not won? Jules asks. Would you have still tried to overthrow Mirabella? Or Arsinoe?
It doesn't matter, says Amelia softly. That is not what happened.
When the stew arrives, it is good, though perhaps not good enough to attract so many diners on its own. Despite her hunger, Jules cannot manage more than a few bites. Her stomach will not stop buzzing.
No appetite? Amelia asks as she licks her bowl.
I'm going to bring the rest up to the room, for Camden.
They snuck the big cat in near dusk through the rear entrance. The water in the second tub was still warm and fairly clean, and not a single one of them caught a claw to the face when they dunked Camden into it.
Camden can eat it herself, Mathilde stands. Off this very table.
Wait, Jules stammers as Amelia rises too. What am I supposed to do?
All you have to do is be you. Amelia smiles and draws her long knives. She drags the point beneath Jules's chin, soft as a caress. And be ready to use your gifts. Mathilde throws back the folds of her gray and yellow cloak. Her voice, though soft, seems to fill the room.
A moment, friends, she says, and steps before their table. I am called Mathilde, from the city of Sunpool, far to the west. I am a seer, and I am a bard, and I would tell you a tale if you would hear it.
She extends an arm toward Amelia, who flashes her blades.
This is Amelia, a warrior and witness to the ascension, to the debacle of the traitor queens in their escape.
A band of warriors aided them, for that's the way I heard it, says a woman in the back. Are you one of them?
I am, Amelia replies.
Then you would fetch a fancy price, delivered to the capital, tied and trussed.
I would. And after we are through, you are welcome to try. She has no weapons that Jules can see, but she does have a table full of friends. As Mathilde recounts Catarine's crimes, most in the room seem curious. They nod when she calls her the undead queen, and a few pound their fists on their tables over the murdered boy. But others keep their lips tight. There are loyalists here, to be sure, and if whispers of Amelia's uprising have not reached Catarine by now, they will after tonight.
We've heard the songs, a young man calls from the crowd. We've heard the tales from other bards in yellow cloaks. A rebellion, they said, led by a new queen. But there is no new queen, unless you've plucked the elemental from the bottom of the sea and brought her back to life.
Then we would have two undeads for the price of one, the woman from the rear calls, and people start to laugh. Another poisoner on the throne, Amelia shouts, and the crowd falls quiet. Is that what you want?
Jules tenses along with everyone else. Eyes dart to Amelia's knives, but no one draws their own. A man with a black cat on his shoulder sits at a table with a boy sharing bread with a sparrow. But past that, Jules sees no evidence of gifts. Perhaps a few elementals, as the wind outside has stilled to nothing.
Is that what you would have? For another generation?
Amelia narrows her eyes.
Another corrupt council, surrounded by death? Who will poison us until our blood runs from our mouths and cuts the heads from children? The triplet queens have been abandoned by the goddess.
But someone with a legion curse has not? The young man asks.
That's the queen you speak of, isn't it? The legion queen?
That is the one we speak of, says Mathilde.
A mad queen on the throne?
She is not mad.
She is not real,
the woman in the rear says, and her table laughs.
She is real,
Mathilde says, her voice carrying into the farthest corners.
And she is different. The Legion Queen is no queen of the blood, but she is blessed just the same, gifted so strongly by the goddess so as to be her champion, our champion, who will vanquish the last of the fading queens, and beside us, we'll forge a brighter tomorrow.
It is like Amelia said. Mathilde's words land in the crowd's ears and make them itch with the flicker of possibility. All Jules can do is sit awkwardly as they stare, knowing what they must be thinking, that this small girl cannot be this fabled soldier. It takes all her restraint not to open her mouth and agree with them.
This little thing?
The woman in the rear of the inn stands and gestures with her mug to Jules, splashing what little ale is left in it across the top of her table.
This little vagrant wretch is supposed to be our champion?
Her friends laugh. But this time, only her friends. And Amelia sheds her cloak and jumps deftly onto a nearby table.
I have had near enough of you, Amelia growls.
Amelia, Jules whispers.
The Legion Queen will fight for the people, even loudmouthed cowards.
The woman scowls.
You'll find no cowards here.
She waits until Amelia lowers the tip of her knife, and then stands and throws a hidden hatchet she had stuck into the wood of her bench. Amelia ducks and pushes it off course. It clatters to the ground behind her, harmless, but the warrior lifts her knife to throw, and Jules knows that she will never miss.
Amelia, don't!
The knife flies, straight for the villager's heart. Jules lurches across the table, hand flung out. She calls to the knife with her gift, fighting against Amelia's good, solid throw. At the last moment, it veers off course so hard that it winds up stuck fast in the ceiling. Every face turns to Jules.
Call her,
Mathilde whispers.
Call her now!
Too stunned to disobey, Jules reaches out for Camden, and every eye darts to the stairs as the cougar bursts through the door. She bounds down the steps and leaps over the rail, landing on tables and upending cups and plates, her snarl ferocious, until she reaches Jules and stands before her to roar.
This is the Legion Queen, Mathilde says to the frozen crowd. The strongest naturalist in 10 generations, the strongest warrior in 200 years. She is the one who will fight for all the gifts. She is the one who will change everything.
The Mainland. The fortune-telling shop that Arsinoe finds has a brass bell over the door. A loud brass bell, and she grimaces as soon as she walks inside. But it seems that the shop is empty. No one there to see her. No one to stare. She reaches up and quiets the bell, and smiles as she thinks of Luke, whose bell back home is not so jarring. Quietly, she unfurls the cloth sack she brought and begins roaming through the shelves. It is easy to find 3 fat white candles, and into the sack they go, knocking together gently.
You are not from here?
Arsinoe spins and finds herself face to face with the shopkeeper, a woman in beads and silks and dark curling hair.
No, madam. I've had to travel over half the city to find a shop like yours.
The shopkeeper laughs.
That's not what I meant. How can I help you today?
Without warning, she tugs the cloth sack open and peers inside. Her mouth crooks down.
White candles? A less interesting purchase than I'd hoped.
I also need herbs and oil.
You didn't need to cross the city for those.
I suppose I could have swiped the herbs from the kitchen, says Arsinoe.
but then my hosts would have complained when their meat was bland. I know you have the herbs here. I can smell them.
The woman leads her toward the back, where there are racks and racks of dried herbs and mushrooms, kept in jars or bound in bundles with butcher's string. Arsinoe selects which herb she needs, something that will give off plenty of smoke when burned, something that will lend its aroma, but not so strongly as to be distracting. Her hand hovers over a bundle of sage. Then she changes her mind and frowns. Low magic is the only link to the island that the goddess can hear on the mainland. So Madrigal said, but it would need help to be heard so far away. Here there is no bent-over tree, no sacred valley to whisper her curses into. The oil and the herbs, the flames of the candles would lend her focus. Raise her voice over the waves of the sea all the way back to Fenburn, perhaps even into the past, to the time of the Blue Queen.
Have you tried burning amber or resins?
The shopkeeper reaches up onto a shelf. She hands Arsinoe a chunk that looks like Grandma Kate's nut brittle, but smells like an evergreen.
It will burn longer, give you more time.
She laughs again at Arsinoe's suspicious face.
So surprised to find a fortune teller in a fortune-telling shop?
Yes, I know what you're up to. She drops more resin into Arsinoe's sack and gestures for her to follow behind a curtain to a smaller room filled with crystals and clear orbs for seers.
How does a shop like this exist here?
Arsinoe asks.
It doesn't, not in the fine parts of town. But as long as we stay buried in the slums, and as long as we provide harmless diversions for the ladies, fortune-telling and seances, they don't run us out.
She unlocks a cabinet and reaches inside.
Are you from here?
I am, but my grandmother wasn't.
Do you know who I am? Arsinoe asks warily.
The woman peers at her.
I know you are reaching out for answers, and I know that you don't fear the price.
The last bit, she said, staring through Arsinoe's sleeves, as if she could trace the scars from the low magic cuts.
Here, the last of what you will need.
She walks to Arsinoe and slides a bottle into her hand. Pretty blue frosted glass, stoppered with a cork. Arsinoe stares at it as she follows her back to the register.
How much is this?
How much do you have? She reaches into her trouser pockets, fishes out her handful of coins and lays them on the counter.
It is that much, the shopkeeper says and sweeps them away.
It can't be. Just the bottle must be worth more.
Take it, the woman says. And take care. Your journey begins. I do not see where it ends. Only that it does.
Only that it does. The woman's words echo through Arsinoe's head all the way back through the city until she reaches the cemetery and Joseph's grave, where she has arranged to meet Mirabella. The words could mean anything.
Or they could be just the mumblings of a fake fortune-teller.
Did you get everything? Arsinoe jumps when Mirabella steps out from behind one of the trees near the path.
What are you doing, creeping around? You're as bad as Camden on padded feet.
She runs her hand through her growing hair. Soon it will be time to cut it again and further horrify Billy's mother.
Why were you hiding?
I was not hiding. I was sitting in the shade.
Where's Billy?
He left me at the gate, so as not to interfere. Arsinoe cranes her neck. The grounds are deserted, as usual. She kneels beside Joseph's grave and begins to unload the contents of her sack.
I cannot believe I agreed to this.
Mirabella lowers herself onto the grass to help. She takes up the blue bottle and holds it to the light.
We should have come after dark.
The fire would have caused even more attention then. Arsinoe sets the three candles in a triangle atop the grass where Joseph lies. But perhaps that is too close. She needs the aid of his island blood, but she does not want to disturb him.
He would disapprove, you know?
I know. And then he'd help us anyway.
The words catch in her throat, and she and Mirabella look sadly at the grave marker. It is so fresh, so bright among the other older gravestones on the hill. It is still hard to believe that he is gone. Together, she and Mirabella lay the other items from the sack on the grass, the pieces of resin, the oil, and finally, Arsinoe's sharp little dagger. Arsinoe uncorks the oil and sniffs. The scent is sweet and herbal. She shakes some onto the ground, then dabs a bit onto her forehead and chest. She does the same to Mirabella, who crinkles her nose. Would it be possible to do a banishing spell? Could we use these same things to send the Blue Queen away and get rid of your dreams?
Maybe, Arsinoe replies. But somehow, I don't think it would work. She pauses and looks at her sister a bit guiltily. I think I've come to like her. Daphne, I mean.
Mirabella dabs at the oil in the bottle and rubs it between her fingers. What did she show you last night, when you struggled?
She showed me her hatred of Duke Brandon of Salcades.
The handsome suitor? And why does she hate him?
Because he is ruining her Henry's chances?
No, Arsinoe says darkly.
Because he is wicked.
Well, Mirabella adjusts her legs to sit in a more comfortable position.
You do not have to worry too much. History tells us that Henry Redville becomes Ilion's king consort, and that Salcades becomes the leader of the losing battle against the island. I didn't know about Salcades.
Arsinoe shoves her lightly.
Don't spoil it for me.
The preparations complete, she rubs her hands together and gestures to the candles.
Can you use your gift to light these?
All three?
Mirabella squints doubtfully. What about just the resin?
Mirabella focuses until sweat beads on her temples. It is difficult to watch when Arsinoe has seen her summon a ball of flame straight into her open palm, with a wish, with a thought.
But just when Arsinoe thinks Mirabella will give up, the resin lights and starts to smoke.
Mirabella exhales and laughs, and the candles ignite in a rush. Around them, the wind stills, the birds and insects quiet. Is this a good sign? Mirabella asks.
Any sign is a good sign.
Arsinoe takes up the dagger and cuts a small crescent into the curve of her arm. The sting is familiar, but it does not feel the same as it did beneath the bent-over tree. There is a flatness to it. The pain is thin and bitter as a dirty coin in her mouth.
Give me your arm.
She cuts Mirabella a crescent to match. The first scar upon her flawless skin. What should I do? Mirabella asks, as their blood drips before the candles and sinks into the earth where Joseph lies.
Reach out to the island with your mind. Let it find you.
Arsinoe starts, and then the shadow of the tree changes. It grows darker. It grows deeper. It grows legs. The shadow of the Blue Queen slinks toward them as if made of smoke, if smoke could bend the grass and stamp it down into footprints. When she climbs atop Joseph's headstone and perches there like a hideous crow, Mirabella jerks, perhaps to run away or perhaps to knock her off, but Arsinoe holds her fast.
What do you want?
Mirabella asks. The Blue Queen stretches out her arm. She points a finger toward the sea, toward the island.
The island!
Arsinoe stares deep into the void of the ancient queen's face.
We understand, but what do you want?
Why am I dreaming as Daphne? What are you trying to tell me, Queen Ilion?
The Blue Queen makes a sound, a shriek, the groan of a dead jaw yawning open. The sound grows until it becomes a wind, and Arsinoe ducks over the lit candles. But they remain lit, flickering, as Mirabella uses her gift to push back.
We are like you, Mirabella says. We are of your line. Tell us what you want from us or leave us in peace.
The screaming wind slows, and the Blue Queen puts her hands to her throat. Her head twists back and forth.
She can't speak, says Arsinoe. She's trying.
Go!
It is a croak. One word, then again.
Go!
She claws at her mouth, points again to Fenburn.
Go!
We cannot go back. Mirabella gets to her feet. We escaped. We are never going back.
She binds the cut on her arm with a strip of cloth and ties it off with her teeth, grabs her sister and staunches her blood as well. Without the boost of fresh queen's blood, the shadow pales. It slackens. It points one last time and then disappears, taking the wind with it.
Why did you stop her?
Arsinoe asks, as the sounds of birds and insects return to the cemetery.
She was getting stronger.
Maybe that is why I stopped her.
But she had more to tell us. I know she did.
Arsinoe. Mirabella snuffs out the candles and stomps the last of the smoking resin. She stuffs everything back into the sack and twists it closed.
Do you not think that what she wants is for us to go back and be killed? That we were not supposed to get away?
But the dreams are bait. They are a trap. Mirabella puts a hand on Arsinoe's shoulder as she looks out toward the bay. And even if they are not, it is not worth the risk. The Reaping Moon. Roland.
It was a mistake to come here, Peter says, as the carriage approaches the elemental city of Rolanth. We should have stayed in Indrid Down.
And celebrate the Reaping Moon Festival in the midst of a chanting mob?
Genevieve arches her brow.
You think there will not be chanting mobs in Rolanth? The entire island has heard about...
He glances apologetically at Catarine.
What happened to that boy?
That assassin, you mean? The one whom the queen made an example of?
The queen and her court are to stay at the finest hotel in Rolanth. The high priestess herself made the arrangements in conjunction with Sarah Westwood. Catarine drops open the carriage window and takes a deep breath of the crisp northern air. So many white buildings built into the hills. Limestone and marble facing the sea, stark against the black basalt cliffs that run up the northeastern coast, that place that they call Shannon's Blackway. Rolanth is brighter than Indrid Down, with the clear water of the river rushing through the center and the many green spaces of parks and gardens. Hard to believe that anything could go wrong in such a beautiful place. She has brought nearly her whole black council to ensure it, except for Cousin Lucien, Ro Mertra, and Paola Vend. Some had to stay behind, so it would not appear that they are fleeing, though that is precisely what they are doing. When the carriage stops, Genevieve leaps out to see that all has been prepared. Peter takes Catarine's hand to escort her into the hotel. Their room takes up the entirety of the uppermost floor, a lovely space, with ivory walls and blue velvet on the bed. Catarine removes her traveling hood and throws it onto an oval table. Then she swings the windows open and leans out.
Stay away from the windows, Cat.
Peter closes it up and tugs her back to the center of the room. How long will you remain angry with me, Peter? For what happened to that boy?
I am not angry with you.
He unbuttons his jacket
and slings it onto a chair. I am protective, though I do wonder why you are not angrier with yourself.
I was. I am.
Are you? We must brand that poor boy a traitor and not even allow him to be burned, just so we can say that the queen was in the right?
I was in the right. He attacked me, Catherine says, but her voice lacks conviction. The boy had been no real threat. She could have disarmed him. Instead, she put a knife up through his throat.
Natalia would say it is more important for a queen to be feared than to be loved.
Peter frowns. Natalia would never say that. Not in this case. Genevieve sweeps into the room, having finished her cursory inspection of the hotel. She glances between them and rolls her eyes at Peter.
Will you never stop telling her she is wrong, nephew? Will you never stop thinking of what is best for your cat and begin to think about what is best for the rain?
Murdering subjects is never what is best for the rain. Fear is one thing, but not for a queen as unpopular as this. Heaping fear upon dislike breeds hatred, and hatred makes the people likely to bite.
Genevieve sighs. The people will forget. You have been in the game for so little time, Peter. It will be years before your advice is of any value.
A lump of frustration rises in Catherine's throat. She knows what comes next. Peter's pale cheeks will gain color, his teeth will grind, he will shout, and Genevieve will shout back, and Catherine will want her head to explode.
Genevieve, she says quickly, go and see to the festival grounds.
Yes, Queen Catherine.
She curtsies and leaves, and Peter slams the door so fast it nearly catches the seat of her trousers. Catherine returns to the window.
Cat,
I am perfectly safe this high up.
She looks out. In Roland, the sun shines and the sea sparkles. The sky is clear. There is no mist hovering on the water without cause, and there are no missing fishers bobbing in the waves. Peter's hands slide up her arms. His fingers slip into her hair, and she lets her head fall back against his chest. His touch is a balm. It brings her back into her own body.
It was not you with that boy, was it, Cat? It was them, the dead queens.
I do not know.
Yes, you do. It is just that you do not want to admit it. Why? Do you think I will think you evil?
No.
Then why?
To protect them.
She squeezes his hands.
As they have protected me. They are a part of me now, Peter. And what they give is worth the cost of what they take.
Even the life of a young boy?
Catherine closes her eyes. She sees that young man's face. She sees it in her dreams. But she tries not to think of him while she is awake. The dead queens seem to like it, and that feels so very wrong.
That will never happen again, she says. Never.
How can you be sure? Can you calm them? Can you keep them from putting you in such danger?
You calm them.
She turns and pulls his mouth to hers.
As you calm me.
The day of the Reaping Moon Festival, Catherine is to be dressed by Sarah and Bree Westwood. No fewer than 6 servants enter alongside them, bringing dozens of gowns and several boxes of gloves, several cases of jewels, before bowing and departing to give them privacy. Dressing the queen, particularly for one of the high festivals, is a great honor, though one would not know it by the sour looks on Bree's and Sarah's faces.
Mistress Westwood.
My queen.
Sarah Westwood curtsies deep, her eyes on the floor.
We thank the queen for extending this invitation.
Catherine looks with compassion on the stiffness in the woman's back, the gray of her hair.
it did not used to be so gray. Even as recently as the Queen's duel, Sarah's hair was a bright, vibrant brown. I would not think to extend it to anyone else in Rowanth. They have brought the one-handed priestess, Elizabeth, with them as usual, and the girl busies herself straightening dresses and whispering to Bree. At one point, Bree laughs, and Elizabeth prods her jovially with the stump of her wrist. They are good friends, even without Mirabella to bind them together. Catarine clears her throat, softly. I would wear my own gloves. She holds her arms up. She has already put a pair on, above her dark linen chemise. As you like, my queen. Sarah nods curtly and shuts each of the glove cases. Though the ones we have brought are more fashionable. I am rather particular about them. Is that why you are standing there in nothing but gloves and your underpants? Bree asks. Or is it because you do not want us to look upon your scars? She steps close with a pair made of pretty black lace. Everyone knows that your hands were ruined escaping your fate at the quickening ceremony. Take the gloves. She slaps them into Katarine's palm. Slowly, and feeling their eyes on her every movement, Katarine strips the fabric down her arm. Deep furrows in the skin from poisons being cut in by knife show like inverted veins. Shining pink circles mark the places where old blisters ruptured. And her hands. Her hands are a ruin of rough and patched together skin, torn and altered from her crawl out of the Breccia domain. The lace will not hide that.
Try these, Queen Katarine.
Elizabeth smiles warmly.
These are even lovelier.
More lace, but this time stitched over thin black fabric. With a gentle touch, the priestess helps her into them, stretching them carefully, as if it might still cause Katarine pain. Bree, who has been watching with a soft expression, hardens when Katarine looks at her.
It's good.
She nods and selects a gown, black silk fitted through the hip. She will need a dense cloak for the evening, says Sarah, but the low, loose skirt will flare nicely in the winds.
What about this one, then?
Bree holds another in front of Katarine.
A similar cut, but thicker material and lined.
So many choices,
Katarine whispers.
Yes, well. Some queens are harder to dress than others.
Bree whispers back.
Are you angry with me, Bree?
Across the room, Sarah and Elizabeth continue sorting through shoes and jewels. Perhaps they truly cannot hear.
What? You thought I would be sympathetic, or even a friend, after one moment of civil conversation by a window?
She snorts.
I thought, perhaps you were just a lonely girl, and I should give you a chance. But then I remember that not an hour afterward, I watched you put a knife into the throat of one of your own people.
She moves away roughly.
I was not myself,
Katarine says, keeping her voice low.
I was afraid.
I saw your face.
The way you looked, you were not afraid of anything. I regret it. I would take it back, I truly would. But I cannot say that...
My queen, says Sarah Westwood,
and Katarine turns to find a long strand of fat black pearls in her face.
These, perhaps. I once heard that you favored them.
Yes, thank you.
She says and hears the door open and slam shut behind Bree's rapid exit. Bree is not in the carriage when it arrives to take Katarine to the festival. Only Sarah Westwood and the priestess Elizabeth will accompany her and Peter to the grounds of Moorgate Park in the center of the city. But Katarine makes no comment. It is a fast ride along the river, perhaps too fast, as twice the horses shy and nearly fall.
They are unused to the steep roads, says Peter.
It is the winds. Every elemental gift is running high today, and the winds will be wild until dark, when the fires begin.
Sarah taps Elizabeth on the shoulder.
Elizabeth, will you trade places with Master Aaron to be nearer to the horses?
Of course.
They trade seats, and the pace of the carriage eases.
Elizabeth still has some of the naturalist gift about her, Sarah explains.
That is why I so often see you feeding the birds, says Catherine, and the priestess smiles.
Outside, Rowan passes by, decorated with dyed flags hung for the reaping moon. Throughout the marketplace, Catherine has seen the flags and banners being sold, dyed in shades of blue and yellow, silver and gold. The more skilled artisans have woven great cloth fish with shining scales in myriad colors, which puff up with the wind when they swallow it. All across the island, folks celebrate the reaping moon for the coming harvest. But in Rowlanth, it marks the last of the fish runs and the arrival of winter's bluster.
You must be happy to have your daughter home, Sarah.
The capital is Bree's home now, Sarah replies, as expected. But Catherine sees through her. She is happy, more than happy. She is relieved. To her, Indrid Down is dark and full of poisoners, full of death. The carriage stops, and Catherine's Queensguard assembles to escort her onto the festival grounds. Moorgate Park is hung with streamers and flags and many brightly colored sewn fish. Festival-goers laugh and dance throughout, feasting on smoked herring on skewers and drinking spiced wine.
Queen Catherine!
Genevieve comes to her as soon as she sets foot on the white stone path.
There is a pleasant place prepared for you, beside the fountain and the canal, where you may observe the festival.
With Peter by her side, Catherine takes her place next to Sarah and High Priestess Luca. Servants bring her a cup of warmed wine and three fish on skewers, and the musicians move closer and resume their play. Soon enough, dancers flood the paved stones and even spill onto the grass.
Peter Aaron, will you dance?
Catherine's mouth drops open at the sight of Bree. She has come from nowhere, slipping through the crowd to stand before Peter and the Queen with her hand outstretched. Her festival gown is midnight blue and thread of silver. It leaves her arms and shoulders bare and hugs her breasts like the two have not seen each other in ages. Peter frowns.
The Queen has only just arrived.
Go, Peter.
Catherine squeezes his hand.
You will truly be the envy of every person in attendance.
As you wish.
He stands and lets Bree lead him onto the floor. For a few steps, he tries to keep up. But though Peter is a wonderful dancer, it is clear he is no match for the limber legs looping between his own. Before long, the other dancers take notice and whistle encouragement to spur Bree on. Luca touches Catherine's hand and speaks from the side of her mouth.
She is only doing it to irritate you. It is her way.
I know that. Of course I know that.
Bree presses against Peter's chest and slings a thigh up to his hip. His frown begins to soften. He looks at Catherine desperately. Everyone is looking at her. Genevieve with curious intensity, Sarah with nerves and a straight back. The people, ready to grin the moment Catherine starts to cry or shout. But instead, Catherine laughs.
Louder! Play louder! Play faster!
She whistles, and Bree stops in surprise. Then she smirks, bows, and begins again. Poor Peter breaks out in a sweat, and the crowd cheers.
Poor, poor Peter. He has never looked so uncomfortable,
stiffly resisting all of Bree's advances. It seems an age before the song ends, and Bree bows to Catarine with her hands on her hips, admitting defeat. Catarine rises and walks through the clapping dancers into Peter's arms.
How dare you do that to me?
He spins her around. Did you really not like it? She twines her leg around his calf.
I was thinking of asking her to teach me.
Teach you?
His scowl fails and he breaks into a smile.
Do you think she would?
They spin together, and he laughs. It is good to see him laugh.
Even so close to you, I am cold, he says as wind ruffles his collar. Sometimes I envy these elementals for their resistance to the weather.
Yes, Catarine mutters. The cold does not bother her as much. Some of the dead queens carried the elemental gift, and what she borrows from them is enough to shield her from it. The fires will begin soon, and then the winds will quiet, like Sarah said. A scream cuts through the music.
What is it?
Asks Peter. He glances quizzically at Genevieve, who may have a better view from the queen's table. But Catarine knows. She and the dead sisters feel it, even before the panic breaks out beside the river. They feel it before the mist rises out of the water and stretches across the ground.
Get the people out of here, Peter.
It is too late.
The panic begins, and Peter throws himself across the queen as they are battered by fleeing bodies. High Priestess Luca is on her feet, trying to direct the crowds to the south and west. People fall and are trampled. They are swallowed up by the mist, come to the center of the city via the river. Catarine wonders where they will be found again, or if they will be found at all.
Queen Catarine,
Genevieve takes her by the arm.
We must get you back to the hotel.
At the hotel, shut up safely inside with Queen's Guard posted around the building, the members of the Black Council gather in the Queen's room. It takes a while for them all to arrive, and every time the door opens, Catarine sighs with relief. Luca and Bree and Antonin are there. Genevieve and Peter were the first to the hotel with her. Renata Hargrove scurries through the door last, shivering in a gray cloak. And after several moments, Catarine begins to panic, worried about Cousin Lucien, until she remembers that he remained in Indra Down, with Paola Vend and the Priestess Ro.
How many are gone? Catarine asks. How many were taken?
None can say. Eyes come to rest on Renata, since she was the last to arrive.
It is too early to tell, Queen Catarine. Not all have been found. And when I was running, it was still happening.
But it is over now. Catarine was at the window the moment they reached the top floor, scanning the city for Moorgate Park. She saw the mist, spread out in thick white fingers, saw it hover over the festival grounds and hesitate at the edges of the city streets. The air was still full of people's screams, the sound made small by the distance, and somehow even more frightening.
It receded, she says, and Renata shudders. I watched it from the window. It returned to the river and back out to the sea to disappear.
It took them so quickly.
Antonin pours tainted brandy for himself and the other poisoners, and drinks it all down at once, his hand shaking.
And the way their screams cut off, like they were being choked.
Some passed through the mist unharmed, Luca notes. But others?
Others we will find torn to pieces and decomposed, bobbing in Barden Harbor when we return to the capital.
Genevieve pours more brandy. She is so rattled that she even pours a cup of untainted wine for Luca.
Do you think Lucien and Paola are all right? Antonin asks. Is it happening there as well? Or only here?
Ro is there, Luca says vaguely, as if that makes all the difference.
Catherine turns to Bree. Bree, are your mother and Elizabeth safe?